Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The Hargan women seemed to have it all.
We were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But detectives would soon discover...
Inside the house, there were the bodies of two women.
A story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true.
I am just praying to God, this is a sick joke.
From 48 Hours, this is Blood is Thicker, the Hargan family killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, the Hargan family killings, starting May 8th, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Alarm, alarm. Welcome to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. And James and I are still at, or back at, depending on how you listen to these, at the National Archive.
A week on.
Here, we've hung around for a week to record another one. Yes, that's slightly unlikely. Although you're here, how often are you here?
Not that often, actually, to be perfectly honest. Not that often. I do little splurges. So I come up and I do kind of, you know, a couple of days or something and absolutely power it.
And how does
photograph it photograph everything, take it all home.
How does it compare to, say, the German archive?
Oh my God, this is now the most user-friendly, easy to navigate archive there is.
Well, you couldn't be any happier but to hear that, surely.
Absolutely, and I promise you I didn't put you up to any of that. So no, thank you very much. I'm glad. It's always lovely to hear that we provide such a good service. You know, we also do have over 350 research guides for those who are interested and are perhaps intimidated by archival research as well. So do check those out. They will.
Yeah,
help.
I mean, I've, you know, done all of mine online, and because one of the things is there is an awful lot of stuff online now, and you can pretty much follow your nose online. Now, and you have to join some things and pay some subscriptions and stuff, but can find your way. I tend to do it via journals to the what they're quoting, you know, or what they're referencing from. But I mean, it is potentially an intimidating thing, isn't it? Because you 11 million documents, the sheer sort of, it's a cliff face of information, isn't it? And how you pick the one that's the document that tells the story that. You know, there's the great, I mean, the thing historians are taught, isn't it, at universities, how to sift and weigh and balance documents against each other and, you know, not pick the wrong one.
The only thing I'd say here is what you could do with is a stack of A3 pieces of card. Because the most annoying thing is seeing the shadow of your iPhone on the document or your hand or whatever. Because I always like it, when I photograph it, I like it to look like a photocopy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sort of digitized version. So your shot is completely above it. It's not at a weird angle. It's flat. It's all that kind of stuff. You want it to look as...
There'll be an app that turns terrible photographs of documents into apparent photographs.
I know, but it's a fact. You haven't got time to do all that.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
You haven't got time to do all that. But if you've got a piece of card, you can hold it over above to shield from the light and you get no shadow.
There's a pro tip for the listener. Now, last time we spoke about prisoners of war and their different experiences in Southeast Asia and then in Europe, including Bums of Broadway, or whatever it was called, at Stalag Luft 3. And I'm just imagining a production of Merchant of Venice in Nazi Germany. How do you play Shylock in, you know, I mean, it's just, that just throws
well, there's
up,
a thought, isn't
just
it?
Throws up so many questions.
Yeah.
Anyway, but today, and it's a different day to the last recording we did, honest, we're looking at the story of civilian internees here in the UK, because one of the things with the new exhibition is it's not just about the prisoner of war experience and the British prisoner of war experience. It's about more than that.
Absolutely it is. So, you know, one of the things we really wanted to do with the exhibition was tell that civilian story as well, and that story of, for want of a better word, incarceration during the Second World War. And again, alongside or indeed kind of to complement a lot of the, I suppose, the inspiration for the exhibition in some ways was some of the work that we've been doing around our records to do with prisoners of war, as well as those to do with civilian internees. We have incredible teams of volunteers who have helped to catalogue, we talk about the catalogue, have helped to catalogue and essentially open up records that we previously weren't able to open up to the public. And again, you know, that's ultimately what was the inspiration for the exhibition. And the internee side, the civilian internee side, was one part of that. And perhaps one of the, you know, not one for kind of lesser known or untold stories in kind of that cliched way, but certainly in comparison to the prisoner of war story and the prisoner of war escape story, the internee side.
Well, and also, I mean, there's an opportunity to simply contrast as well, isn't there? The British government held a fair few prisoners itself, and as well as actual soldiers and airmen, and you know, and there is a German Great Escape after all.
Absolutely,
here in the British Isles,
there's also the big roundup of civilians, enemy aliens, as they were called. You know, which starts sort of from April 1940, really is a big spread, and then it really accelerates into May, June, and July 1940, where there's a kind of invasion scare, you know, and it's a sort of bang up the lot of them. You know, that's the famous sort of misquote by Churchill. But it's pretty ruthless, you know, at the point where Britain thinks, you know, it's that rabbit in headlights moment in the second half of May where it looks like France is going to collapse and suddenly it's all going horribly wrong on the continent, and people are expecting kind of, you know, German parachutists and nun uniforms dropping from the sky and all the rest of it. There is real, genuine panic. And this is the height of the fifth columnist idea. And this idea of the fifth column is that there is this, you know, subversive, ordinary people. They look like you and I, but they're all amongst us and they're kind of working for the enemy. It's all this kind of stuff. And so how can you tell whether, you know, a German Jewish refugee or a German au pair or a German steward in a or waiter in a restaurant in London is a fifth columnist and working for the Nazi regime, or whether they're just ordinary people minding their P's and Q's and actually escaping Nazi tyranny?
Italian head waiter at the Ritz, or
whatever. Yeah. So how do you know all that? And so the way to get around that, you haven't got time to process everybody because this is height of war and lots of kicking off on the continent. So you just round everybody up and chuck them in camps. But the camps then have to be created. And it's extraordinary, the experiences, because until the, I mean, a lot of them are sent to the Isle of Man, of course, famously. But until then, you've got to find, you know, holding dumps for them. I mean, a lot of women were put in Holloway Prison, for example, as just internees. And then there was a terrible mill, wasn't there, near Manchester, Salford or something like
what,
that.
So what does the archive tell us about this?
So it tells us a lot about the process, you know, the decision-making around those things, you know, both in mid to late 1939, the kind of what are we going to do in the event of war? And then when war breaks out, the so-called enemy aliens are assessed locally. You know, there are tribunals essentially to assess individuals.
Which are very mixed in their results.
Absolutely. So an individual is then issued with a card which gives information about whether they're exempt from internment and the reasons. You know, these kind of the back of the card will often have notes and provide details about why an individual might be exempt. But then, as you say, you know, that all gets thrown up in the air in May, June 1940, and, you know, these cards become irrelevant from that point of view, until then the authorities eventually, in kind of the middle of 1941, are looking at releasing more and more internees because it's felt by that point that threat is diminishing. And as I say, you know, certainly the records in the archives will cover a lot of that decision making, but also in a similar way to those Red Cross reports that we were talking about last time, look and assess these camps. What are the conditions like? What can individuals do in by way of recreation? What are they allowed to do? What aren't they allowed to do? You know, what are the regulations ultimately? And again, it's it's done in a very similar way to those kinds of assessments that are made about conditions. And eventually, you know, and again, it's something that comes out in our records here at the National Archives, is the pressure that is put on the government to start releasing internees for a number of different reasons. There's a fairly famous example in that the Arandora Star, which was a ship carrying civilian internees, mainly Italian civilian internees, as well as others, Allied soldiers as well, was sunk, killing a large number of civilians. And that really acts as a bit of a catalyst to that pressure and those calls for releasing internees. And at the very least, stopping internees from being, for want of a better word, deported to places like Canada and particularly Australia. And yeah, there are, again, a few examples of those kinds of voyages, which are quite infamous in the bad conditions that internees are put in, as well as being sent away thousands of miles.
Yeah, and I suppose that it being the British government of the time, they're also trying not to spend any money on it because there's a war to fight, which is why you end up with, on the Isle of Man, you know, basically you barbed wire off a peninsula and you put people in there, you know.
It's so, so bizarre, isn't
it? Yeah.
The Port Erin.
Yeah.
Now, what's it called? Russian camp. Yeah. Russian? R-U-S-H-E-N. Yeah. And it's in that kind of southern peninsula of the southern part of the Isle of Man. And they basically just put barbed wire along one from side to side. There's two villages and everyone in it is part of the camp. And the civilians who are already there are just encouraged to kind of take in the prisoners. They're given a guinea a week, I think.
Yes.
Yeah. Quite a lot of money.
Yeah, absolutely. Because it's essentially a seaside resort. So there's lots of bed and breakfasts and hotels, and that's partly why it was chosen. Yeah. Yeah. And as you say, yeah, those who lived in the area lived in the same houses. They live amongst the internees. They have more freedom than those internees.
The point worth making in this is that within the community is the wrong word, but within the body of the internees, there are people who are Nazis. So it's not like it's a sort of an incarceration of the innocents in totality. That there are people who it's the right thing probably given the set of circumstances to lock them away, as well as lots of Jewish people. And we were talking about this the other day about Russian, where there's the idea that you would be lodging. You know, you might be a German Jew and you're lodging with a Nazi. It's the most extraordinary.
Do you rub along?
How do you live cheek by jowl like that?
When you're given comparative freedoms and you're able to just go for a walk, go for a bathe.
But the big difference is the Nazi has no power in that situation. So they can have all pack all the ideology they want, but they have no power, so they can't act on it.
But what they can do is they say, if you're nice to me, you know, when the Germans come, I'll put in a good word for you.
Oh, I suppose. Yeah, but
there's quite a lot of that going on. I mean, there's written evidence of people saying that. I mean, it's just absurd. But
and a lot of the reports for particularly Russian camp, for example, I mean, they always talk about troublemakers and moving troublemakers around to kind of settle some of those, again, and they use kind of language like to settle those disputes is the kind of language that's used.
But they have their own little sort of finance system in Russian camp where they give out tokens, because some people have quite a lot of money and some people don't. And so then it's sort of unfair on the people that haven't, because you can just go around and go to the shops. Yeah. So the whole economy in Russian camp is based on tokens.
Yes, for a period of time, yes, absolutely it is.
Bonkers. Well, it's rather brilliant, actually.
Yeah, and because there's also a disparity as well. So just thinking about, you know, promises. So what the German authorities are doing is sending care packages to German internees, but an individual had to swear allegiance to the Reich in order to receive those packages. So you also then get a disparity within the camp of individuals who are willing to do that, obviously then against those who are not willing to do that. And some of whom
cross fingers.
Yeah, well, and that's it. Some of them are, want of a better phrase, apolitical. They're not Nazis necessarily, but they are willing to do that in order to
But the other point, of course, is that he might be a Nazi, but so what? I mean, it's not going to do you any good, is it? Or I mean, you're an impotent Nazi, and so to a certain extent, that's fine.
It's fascinating, isn't it? Because after all, you know, with the Geneva Convention, what does that say about civilian internees? Because after all, whenever people talk about the Geneva Convention, they immediately think it's about prisoners of war. It's about, but these people are prisoners of war. They're just not. They're not in uniform. They're not ex-combatants or whatever. And so that starts to talk to the relationship between the state and a civilian and a foreign civilian. And because after all, you know, states have their obligations to their own civilians and their own citizens, as it were. But where's the line drawn? And that's what this is asking questions around, isn't it? And creating argument around, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so because, you know, the 1929 conventions say very little about civilians. And that's partly what the 1949 convention does, is kind of rectify that to some degree. But I think what happens early on, and again, you see the back and forth between the British and German authorities in wartime, you know, sometimes through a neutral power, so not necessarily directly, where kind
maybe
of
Switzerland.
Yes, or Sweden, Sweden as well, where they're kind of agreeing that civilians would be treated be protected in similar ways to prisoners of war. So they're kind of doing or making that decision that, you know, either initially informally, and then they actually start to have those kinds of conversations which stipulate, yes, this is what we're going to do when it comes to civilians in the UK or civilians in Germany, is we will treat them in line with prisoners of war, which is why you do then get Red Cross inspections of civilian camps, both in Europe and also in the UK.
Yeah. We'll take a break and we'll look at some documents.
The holidays have arrived early with Blinds.com's Spring Black Friday sale. Upgrading window coverings can be a minor project with a major impact. Blinds.com makes it easy and affordable. Browse premium blinds, shades, shutters. We have your patio covered too. And get unlimited window treatments installed for one low cost. Free shipping and Blinds.com's 100% satisfaction guarantee. Shop Blinds.com's Spring Black Friday sale now. Save up to 45% plus premium doorbusters. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Going for your first ever run around the park. Literally running errands all over town. Running for the finish line and your personal best. If you run, you're a runner. Find the shoes and clothes to run your way at newbalance.com/running. New Balance. Run your way.
This episode is brought to you by Atlassian. Atlassian software like Jira, Confluence, and Loom help power the collaboration needed for teams to accomplish what would otherwise be impossible alone. Because individually we're great, but together we're so much better. That's why millions of teams around the world, including 75% of the Fortune 500, trust Atlassian software for everything from space exploration and green energy to delivering pizzas and podcasts. Whether you're a team of 2, 200, or 2 million, Atlassian software is built to keep you connected and moving together as one.
Welcome back to We Have Ways of Making You Talk here at the National Archive, TNA. I'm down with the lingo now. It was the PRO to me for a very long time.
But you've moved on at last.
I'm finally getting with the program, Daddy-O. We're looking at some documents now about what we were just talking about. And Jim is thumbing right this second the Aliens Restriction Act of 1922. So they were thinking about this couple of decades beforehand. Well, that's quite interesting in itself that there's a piece of law.
Yeah, but look where this comes. So this is the Aliens Restriction Order of 1940, based on the Aliens Restriction Act of 1922. The Government Office, Isle of Man, yep. 12th of June 1940. Aliens shall not have in their possession or under their control or use any motor vehicle or bicycle, any camera or other photographic apparatus, any telescope, field glasses or other optical instrument, any nautical chart or any seagoing craft or aircraft. Well, that's pretty obvious, isn't it?
The Isle of Man, is this Isle of Man law or British government law? Because the Isle of Man is a sort of half in, half out, isn't it?
Yeah, so it's British government law, and essentially the British government approaches and asks the Isle of Man to do this in that way. So,
His Excellency Vice Admiral, the Right Honourable, the Earl Granville, CBDSO, Lieutenant General Governor of the said Isle, etc., etc., etc.
What's interesting is, and obviously this is sort of the point, there's an it doesn't say who the aliens are. There's an understanding of who they are. We all know who that means.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, what a lot of these orders, and this particular document is a number of different, kind of covering a number of different areas. So that first one you read out there, James, was obviously focused on perhaps items transport. That might be transport and items that might be deemed as
spying
used
kit.
For spying. Yeah, absolutely. But there's also other things. So around the use of telegrams, about sending and receiving letters, that's incredibly limited. And then there are later ones around banking. So individuals had to deposit valuables and money into the camp bank, if you like, and could only withdraw a certain amount every week.
You could write letters, though, if they were censored, couldn't you?
Yes, but you were limited to a certain number a week. So, yeah, so you could, they were censored, you could write, both send and receive letters. But, yeah, they were limited, and I think the size was also limited. It was up to four sides.
Right. You've just pointed out, Al, what they've got the classification. Point six, an enemy alien shall mean a national of any state with which His Majesty is at war, and shall include a stateless alien.
So that's Germany... Russian internment camp rules, amended 9th of September 1940. Household control. The householder is under the commandant, the responsible authority for the internal control of each household, and may appoint a representative for the internees if he or she so desired, elected by other internees to assist in the arrangement of duties. Lights out. Internees must be in their own rooms with lights out at 10 p.m. and silence thereafter. I mean, it's like... boarding school.
Nice little details I can weave back in at the proof.
You can't
proof
smoke
stage.
In your bedroom, Jim.
No.
No meetings in bedrooms.
I know, I'm just sort of thinking, I mean, this is 9th of September, this is after my period that I've been writing about, but, you know, when it comes to the copy edit, I can still...
It's good stuff.
Weave a little bit, can't you?
You're not allowed food in your bedroom. You're not allowed to lock your bedroom. No flame lamps, stoves.
Not allowed to throw anything out windows.
No, you're not allowed to hang pictures. I mean, this is like a rental agreement from the mid-90s.
yes, and it'll cost you £18 a week.
Exactly, yes. To visit bars and to attend dances in public halls or cafes, or to purchase any alcoholic drink. I mean, that's Joanna M. Cruikshank.
Yes, she was the commandant, yeah, of Russian.
And certainly, so we've got a couple of the reports from the camp, which are put together both after the war, but also as part of visits to the camp. And one of the things that is commented on is the curfew, and particularly during the winter, how individuals had to be back inside the premises in which they were living by, I think, 5:30 in the evening. But, and, you know, again, because it gets dark early, it's seen as a security risk to have individuals out later. I think in the summer it's 9 p.m. is the latest that individuals could be outside.
So we're looking at the report on the visit to the women's camp, internment camp on the Isle of Man. Housing and general conditions. Practically, the whole of the two small watering places of Port Erin and Port St Mary form one large camp under one commandant, which has accommodated between 4,000 and 5,000 internees. I mean, that's quite a lot, really. There are gates with barbed wire at either end of the camp, and wire runs behind the houses at a certain distance from the coast. But within this area, the internees are free to walk about as they please.
Absolutely.
So it
amazing.
Says the permanent residents are, for the most part, proprietors of hotels and boarding houses who formerly relied on their living on summer visitors. Now all the available accommodation is used for the internees. The Home Office paying the householders a flat rate of £1, one shilling, and no pence per week.
Oh, there's a guinea, of course.
For each adult, and 10 and 6 for each child. The management and catering remain in the hands of the householders. Blah, blah, blah. Undoubtedly, there's friction between the internees and the householders and complaints as to food, heating, light. This is very, this is how they're all chiming along. It seems to me that many difficulties and anomalies would have been avoided if from the start the Home Office had taken over all the houses and installed the proprietors as managers at a fixed salary. Gosh, because they're basically, because it's devolved and private, they haven't got control over it.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
That is what's going on there, isn't it? Mm-hmm. That's very interesting.
Yeah. And then... over here, what we have is a similar kind of report.
Let's go clockwise.
So this report was written towards the end of the war, and we've got a lot of this kind of document for lots of different subject areas. So this is kind of a lessons learnt document around internment, and particularly around internment in Russian camp. There's lots of photographs that come with it. But it's essentially... its purpose is in case the authorities have to do it again. Right. And, you know, you get a lot of these documents from, you know, a prisoner of war point of view. There are a lot of these kind of lessons learned documents produced at the end of the First World War, which inform exactly how policy
is carried out during the Second World War. But this is a similar kind of report. And there's lots of photographs in here that looks at some of the, particularly the recreational activities, the education that's going on, because it's both a woman and a children's camp as well. Children could camp, accompany their mothers.
It doesn't look too bad, does it?
Picture the kindergarten.
Again, though, these are propaganda images. Yes. Just
well, I know.
I get that, but even so.
They just haven't got a production of Bums on Broadway. Otherwise, I mean...
Well, maybe they did.
There were operas that were staged in the camp, which are detailed.
I mean, the thing is, yes, it doesn't look that bad, Jim, but these people are not at their liberty. So
no, I know,
so,
I appreciate that.
I know, but this is the thing. I think this is the thing that's very often beguiling about these sort of images is you can in your head say to yourself, oh well, it's not that bad, is it? But you know, they're not allowed out, yeah. And I mean, in a way, it looks like the village in The Prisoner a bit. You know, they're all what could they possibly have to complain about?
I'll tell you what, though, there's a TV drama to be done on Russian camp, isn't there?
There is, yeah, or a sitcom.
Oh, you know, now you're talking.
Quite funny, I think. It's the comic.
Well, you have a comic Nazi.
Well, no, it's just that because there's that amazing story in Berlin about those two lesbians who hide in hide in Berlin in plain sight. They go to the landlady and say, "We're on a secret mission from the Führer." These two avowed Nazis, the landladies and avowed Nazis, say, "We're on a secret mission for you, Führer. You must absolutely not tell anyone that we're staying here." So, and that's a sitcom, surely, in one way or another.
Well, this is a sitcom, isn't it?
But I think it's really, it is interesting, though, because this is dealing with what appears to be a problem. But they phase it out. As you say, it comes to the point where this isn't practical anymore And really, it isn't, is it? I mean, you look at it. Especially if these are people who are opposed to the German government, then they're a resource, aren't they? If you need to translate things, you think of all the men that go into the Pioneer Corps and then are allowed into proper regiments eventually, all that sort of stuff.
Absolutely, and in fact, we then have an example of exactly that kind of process. We have this is an individual file of someone who naturalized after the war, but was initially interned. And freed in September 1941. And she was in Russian camp, Port Erin, and she was essentially a parliamentary agent for the Labour Party before the war, so she was able to exert some pressure politically for the release of civilian internees, including herself, within that, and eventually was deemed not a threat.
Sort of safe.
From that point of view. And again, there is a version of her tribunal card in this paperwork, in this file that we have here, which talks about her being an anti-Nazi and not being a threat.
It doesn't say what she gets classified as.
Class C.
So initially she's Class C, and then she's released as Class C. So September 1939.
I mean, it's ridiculous putting Class C people in.
Yes, absolutely. But yeah, as you say, it's a gradual process, but she's released in September 1941.
I mean, is there any... Because prisoners of war, there are some repatriations. People are ill and stuff can be repatriated. And is there a process in place for civilians to be repatriated? Is there a sort of swapping thing going on?
Yes, absolutely. And it is swapping in that way. It's kind of like for like.
I mean, this is really interesting. So Theresia Tekla Maria Kuck, findings of committee and remarks. This woman is a German born and nationality, having been born on the 24th of June 1903 at Oldenburg. She is Aryan and a single woman. She tells us that she left Germany first to go into the domestic service in Holland in 1922. She returned to Germany in 1924 and went to a convent where she learned hospital nursing for a period of 18 months. From thence, she spent a certain time in a maternity home learning maternity work and returned to Holland to be employed in the same family as employed before in 1926. She remained there, blah, 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 till 1931 when she went to England. She is a woman of intelligence who has satisfied us that she is anti-Nazi and wholeheartedly in favour of the British war effort. She met in 1935 a Mr. Shaler, a married man with whom she fell in love, and they began to live with each other in 1936. We do not think there's any foundation for the suspicions which were expressed as to the activities of this woman in the police report of the 27th of July 1940. And we think that if she were released from internment, that she would present no danger to the security of this country. Accordingly, we recommend that she be placed in Class C.
MI5's observations attached, no camp report. So MI5 have had a good look at her as well. I mean, what a waste of time. It's a time and effort. But, you know,
Her story is a positive one. She naturalised as a British citizen after the war, and so
lived
she
happily ever after.
To Mr. some Shaler? Extent, with Mr. Shelley, they never married, but she took his surname. We know that from her files.
If she'd married him, would she have been in a different situation before the war?
Potentially, because normally at that period, women took the nationality of their husbands.
Because my grandmother came from Vienna with my grandfather in 36, and must have been. Because they don't, she did, none of this happened to her. So, yeah, potentially why. She was from Salzburg.
Yeah, Vienna. I mean, in my book, that she gets classified B because she's still got relations in Germany who are in the party, but because she hasn't taken nationality.
Listen to this. I mean, these documents, this is just brilliant. So this is particulars of internee. So it's all her. Present nationality of birth, German. Present nationality, USA.
So that, I think, is of her father.
Oh, right. Okay. Yes. Oh, yes. That's her father. Yes. So, but look at this. When did you leave your country? April 1932. Why did you leave? Depreciation of the mark.
Mm.
Anyone who's done GCSE history.
Yes, we'll know.
We'll know exactly. Of course, that's why she left then.
Wow. Isn't it amazing, all this?
It is. And like I say, so her file, this file, which obviously we have here in the National Archives collection, is one of a large number of these kinds of files that we have, as well as the tribunal cards, as I've said. And then, you know, you mentioned the Pioneer Corps, for example, and individuals who went on to serve in the armed forces, a number of them in SOE. We have SOE service records,
yes,
as well.
Of course.
Large numbers of individuals who were initially interned in 1940, who then went on to have quite illustrious careers in the
Army. Oh, it's just fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah, it's amazing. Absolutely amazing. That folder alone.
Yeah.
And there's one of those for everybody. It's the
not every single person, but
everyone.
A lot.
But everyone who came out the other end of the
there
process.
There are many.
Oh, I need to quickly get my camera out and stop snapping a few things here.
And this is very new. It was only opened a couple of months ago.
A friend of mine's writing a play about Russian camp.
Is he?
Yeah.
He needs to get himself up here, doesn't
yeah.
he? Very good.
I'll tell her. Yeah, but yes, it's you've made an assumption there, Jim, but it doesn't matter. Yeah, because her mum was interned.
Apologies,
it's
your
right,
friend.
That's right. Her mum was interned. You know, they came in 1938. They fled after Kristallnacht and managed to get into the UK, or her mother did, and then they were interned. So she's writing a play about it. It's amazing. This is just brilliant. So
yeah, it's been fascinating, isn't it?
And one of the reasons we're here, because we have been meaning to come here forever.
Yes.
And we've got here, but also this is all related to the new exhibition, Great Escapes.
2nd of Feb.
2nd of February.
2024.
So save up during January. It's free, so you don't need to save up. So save up the Uber.
And when you're here, get your reader's ticket. And
get your reader's ticket.
Get your reader's card.
Go truffle hunting, basically. Yeah,
exactly. We will have some dedicated research terminals for people who do want to then carry out some research once they've been to the exhibition, or before they've been to the exhibition, or indeed at any time.
At any time. Because that's
honestly, I'm not just saying this because I'm here and you're standing in front of me, but it is an absolutely fantastic archive. It's a total treasure trove. All the staff here are incredibly helpful, and it is very easy to use, and it's a great place. Lovely cafe as well, and you know, facilities and stuff.
Well, the cafe was very busy. It seemed like a place to come if you're local.
There's quite a sort of quite a tricky combination thing on the lockers where you put your bag.
Yeah, right. Okay.
But I set mine to 1939, so I'll never forget it, and it's fine.
Brilliant. So basically, next time you're here, everybody, try every locker. And one will open with 1939, and that's James Holland's stuff.
Still here because I can't get it out.
Because you can't get it out. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Thanks very much, Will, for taking us through this stuff and talking about this area of the Second World War. We'll see you all again very soon. Bye-bye.
Cheerio.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.